and father. He gave me cause to love the work that they had loved. Debt such as that you incur for life. I sailed for Rio de Janeiro, a more contented young man than I had ever been before. On the cruise back to Annapolis, I returned to my place on the bridge. Two officers who were attached to the academy but were not officers in my company had been assigned to the cruise to evaluate our performance. They gave me the best marks, reporting that I had shown a very high aptitude for the service. I had the high grease. Captain Hart was astonished. He was convinced that there had been a terrible error, perhaps a case of mistaken identity. Inspired by my success on the USS Hunt, I resolved to make something of myself in my last year at the academy. I studied hard and maintained a respectful attitude toward my superiors. I set up a tutoring system for plebes who were struggling academically. I managed the battalion boxing team, which won the brigade championship. My grades were improving, and I stayed well out of trouble. I had become, for a brief time, a squared-away midshipman that any company commander could be proud of. Any company commander, save mine. In January, I went to Captain Hart's office to receive my grease grade, which I was confident would elevate me for the first time from the bottom regions of the class standings where I had dwelled in infamy for 3 years. Hart began by noting my improved behavior. "Keep this up, son, and you'll have something to be proud of." When I asked where he had placed me in the company, he mumbled an answer that I couldn't make out. "Where, sir?" "At the bottom," he whispered. "Where?" "At the bottom." Rising from my chair, I glared at Hart, who remained seated. "You can expect nothing more from me, Captain," I said as I left his office, slamming the door so hard behind me that I thought its opaque glass window would break. Any other officer would have shouted at me, "Get back in here and sit down, mister. Where do you get off barking at me like that?" Not Captain Hart. He never spoke of the interview. He knew he had wronged me. For the first time, I had wanted something from him, had felt I'd earned it, and he, dogged to the end, had gotten his revenge. True to my word, I returned to the habits of my first 3 years, accumulating demerits by the dozen. A few months later, I sat amid a sea of Navy whites, fifth from the bottom of my class, listening to President Eisenhower confer our degrees. I was proud to graduate from the Naval Academy. But at that moment, relief was the emotion I felt most keenly. I had already been accepted for flight training in Pensacola. In those days, all you had to do was pass the physical to qualify for flight training, and I was eager to embark on the life of a carefree naval aviator. My father, perhaps mindful of his own performance, rarely chastised me for falling well short of an exemplary midshipman's standards. Appearances to the contrary, it was never my intention to mock a revered culture that expected better of me. The academy, despite the irritating customs of plebe year and the encumbrances it placed on the individualist, was not interested in degrading my dignity. The most important lesson I learned there was that to sustain my self-respect for a lifetime, it would be necessary for me to have the honor of serving something greater than my self-interest. When I left the academy, I was not even aware I had learned that lesson. In a later crisis, I would suffer a genuine and ruthless attack on my dignity, an attack that, unlike the affronts I had exaggerated as a boy, left me desperate and uncertain. It was then I would recall, awakened by the example of men who shared my circumstances, the lesson that the Naval Academy, in its antique way, had labored to impress upon me. It changed my life forever. My early years as a naval officer were an even more colorful extension of my rowdy days at the academy. At flight school in Pensacola, and then at advanced flight training with my pal Chuck Larson in Corpus Christi, Texas, I did not enjoy the reputation of a serious pilot or an up-and-coming junior officer. I liked to fly, but not much more than I liked to have a good time. In fact, I enjoyed the off-duty life of a Navy flyer more than I enjoyed the actual flying. I drove a Corvette, dated a lot, spent all my free hours at bars and beach parties, and generally misused my good health and youth. I crashed a plane in Corpus Christi Bay one Saturday morning. The engine quit while I was practicing landings. Knocked unconscious when my plane hit the water, I came to as the plane settled on the bottom of the bay. I barely managed to get the canopy open and swim to the surface. After x-rays and a brief examination determined I had not suffered any serious injury, I returned to the quarters Larson and I shared. I took a few painkillers and hit the sack to rest my aching back for a few hours. My father learned of the accident immediately and asked a friend, the admiral in charge of advanced flight training, to check on me. Chuck Larson and I had adjoining rooms in the bachelor officer's quarters. We'd moved both our beds into the same room and used the second room to entertain in. The room was, of course, in a constant state of gross disorder. When the admiral contacted by my father arrived, I was asleep and Chuck was shaving. He pounded on the door while Chuck, unaware that a distinguished visitor was at our door, shouted at him to hold his horses. He opened the door to our guest, snapped a salute, and stood nervously while the admiral surveyed the wreckage that was our quarters. Groggily, I thanked the admiral for his concern. Neither he nor my father needed to have bothered. I was out carousing, injured back and all, later that evening. I began to worry a little about my career during my deployments on several Mediterranean cruises in the early 60s. I flew A-1 Sky Raiders in two different squadrons on carriers based in Norfolk, Virginia, on the USS Intrepid for 2.5 cruises in the Mediterranean, and on the nuclear-powered USS Enterprise for one short and one long Mediterranean cruise. The pilots in the squadrons were a close-knit group. We enjoyed flying together, as well as one another's company, while on shore leave in Europe. I found plenty of time to revel in the fun that European ports offered a young, single flyer, spending holidays on Capri, risking my wages in the casinos of Monte Carlo. However, by my second cruise on the Intrepid, I had begun to aspire to a reputation for more commendable achievements than long nights of drinking and gambling. I had started to feel a need to move on, a natural impulse for me, born of the migrant's life I had led since birth. Like my grandfather and father, I loved life at sea, and I loved flying off carriers. Remembering the satisfaction of my days on Commander Farrell's bridge, I volunteered for bridge watches and qualified as an officer of the deck underway, proving capable of commanding a carrier at sea. As I was one of the few bachelors in my squadron, I volunteered on three occasions to spend my leave attending escape and evasion school to prepare myself for the possibility of being shot down in combat. One course took place during a large army exercise in Bavaria, Germany. A number of other pilots and I were released at night in the middle of the Black Forest. We wore our flight suits and were allowed only those belongings that a pilot would normally possess when he ejected during a combat mission, which amounted to a few sea rations. We were given a map and instructed to find our way, undetected, to a designated safe area. Soldiers participating in the exercise were ordered to hunt us down. The Army also broadcast over the radio a reward offer to any German civilians who found us and reported our whereabouts to the authorities. An Air Force pilot and I teamed up and began a careful trek through woods filled with eager soldiers. It took 5 days to reach the safe area. My Air Force friend and I were the only pilots to avoid capture and reach our destination. When we arrived, Special Forces soldiers picked us up and took us to a lovely inn on a lake in a small German village called Unterdiessen, where we remained until the exercise was completed 2 days later. As we had not been captured, nor was I captured during two other similar exercises I participated in, we were not subjected to simulated interrogations or any other unpleasantness associated with being captured in war. In those days, the military emphasized escape and evasion more than it dwelled on life in a prison camp. However, an Air Force major who had been a POW in Korea was brought in to brief us on his experiences, and I shared quarters with him for the 2 days I remained at Bad Tölz. He told us that while he had not experienced a great deal of torture as a POW, American prisoners in Korea had been kept isolated and on near-starvation rations. I remarked that I seriously doubted I could have survived such a long stretch in solitary. He told me I'd be surprised what suffering a man could endure when he had no alternative. In October 1962, I was just returning to home port at Norfolk after completing a Mediterranean deployment aboard the Enterprise. The air wing of a carrier always leaves the ship just before she comes into home port. My squadron had flown off the Enterprise and returned to Oceana Naval Air Station while the ship put in at Norfolk. While at Oceana, we would train out of land bases until the Enterprise's next deployment. A few days after our return, we unexpectedly received orders to fly our planes back to the carrier. I was quite puzzled by the apparent urgency of our mission. The mystery was solved a short while later when all pilots were assembled in the Enterprise's ready room to listen to a broadcast of President Kennedy informing the nation that the Soviets were basing nuclear missiles in Cuba. The Enterprise, sailing at full speed under nuclear power, was the first U.S. carrier to reach waters off Cuba. For about 5 days, the pilots on the Enterprise believed we were going into action. After 5 days, the tension eased as it became apparent the crisis would be resolved peacefully. We weren't disappointed to be denied our first combat experience, but our appetites were whetted and our imaginations fueled. Shortly after, the Enterprise left the Caribbean and returned to port in Norfolk. A little while later, I embarked on my last Mediterranean cruise, an event that marked the end of my days as a completely carefree, unattached, and less than serious Navy flyer. For 9 months after leaving my squadron on the Enterprise, I served on the staff of the Chief of Air Basic Training in Pensacola. A job on an admiral's staff is considered a plum assignment for an ambitious junior officer, and I was lucky to have it. But I was more eager to build my reputation as a combat pilot, and I looked for any opportunity to hurry the day when I would deploy to Vietnam. One day I got a word that Paul Fay, Undersecretary of the Navy at the time, was coming to visit. After a round of meetings, Fay wanted to play a little tennis to relax. I was asked to play with him. After tennis, I took the opportunity to ask the Undersecretary if he could help me get a combat tour in Vietnam. Navy pilots rotate tours of sea and shore duty. Fay knew that I had just begun my rotation on shore duty, but he promised to see what he could do. A few weeks after Fay returned to Washington, I got a call from one of his aides informing me that I would be sent to Vietnam, but not before I had finished my current rotation. I decided to put in for a transfer to Meridian, Mississippi, where, as a flight instructor at McCain Field, I could fly more in preparation for my combat tour. Because Meridian was a remote, isolated location that offered few obvious attractions for pilots at play, I was reasonably serious about my work, and I became a better pilot. My fitness reports began to reflect these first signs of maturity. My superiors began to notice in me faint traces of qualities associated with capable officers. They once selected me as Instructor of the Month. I was also in the middle of a serious romance with Carol Shep of Philadelphia, a relationship that added to my creeping sense that I might have been put on Earth for some other purpose than my own constant amusement. I had known and admired Carol since academy days when she was engaged to one of my classmates. She was a divorced mother of two young sons when we renewed our acquaintance shortly before I left for Meridian. She was attractive, clever, and kind, and I was instantly attracted to her and delighted to discover that she was attracted to me. Carol would occasionally visit me at Meridian, but most weekends, on Friday afternoons, I would take a student pilot on a 4-hour training flight to Philadelphia, refueling at Norfolk on the way. I would arrive at 7 or 8 o'clock in the evening. Carol would be waiting at the airfield to pick me up, and we would go out to dinner. Connie Bookbinder, whose family owned Bookbinder's Restaurant, had been Carol's college roommate, so every evening we would dine there on lobster and drank with friends. On Saturdays, we would go to a football game at Memorial Stadium or a basketball game at the Palestra. We would enjoy some other entertainment on Sunday before I flew back to Meridian on Sunday night. We had been dating for less than a year when I realized I wanted to marry Carol. The carefree life of an unattached naval aviator no longer held the allure for me that it once had. Nor had I ever been as happy in a relationship as I was now. I was elated when Carol instantly consented to my proposal. We were married on July 3, 1965. Carol's two sons, Doug and Andy, were great kids, and I quickly formed a strong affection for them. I adopted them a year after our marriage, and I have been a proud father ever since. A few months later, Carol gave birth to our beautiful daughter, Sydney. That December, I flew to Philadelphia to join my parents at the Army-Navy football game. My mother had brought Christmas presents for Carol and the kids, and I stowed them in the baggage compartment of my airplane on the return flight to Meridian. Somewhere between the eastern shore of Maryland and Norfolk, Virginia, as I was preparing to come in to refuel, my engine flamed out, and I had to eject at 1,000 feet. The Christmas gifts were lost with my airplane. This latest, unexpected glimpse of mortality added even greater urgency to my recent existential inquiries and made me all the more anxious to get to Vietnam before some new, unforeseen accident prevented me from ever taking my turn in war. So it was with some relief that I received my orders at the end of 1966 to report to Jacksonville, Florida, where I would join a squadron on the USS Forrestal and complete replacement air group training. I trained exclusively in the A-4 Skyhawk, the small bomber that I would soon fly in combat missions. Later that year, we sailed through the Suez Canal on a course for Yankee Station in the Tonkin Gulf, and war. Tom Ott had just handed me back my flight helmet after wiping off the visor with a rag. Tom was a second-class petty officer and a fine man. He had been my parachute rigger since I had come aboard the USS Forrestal several months earlier. A parachute rigger is responsible for the maintenance and preparation of a naval aviator's equipment. Tom had heard me complain that I often found it difficult to see through my visor, so we always came on deck before launch to clean it one last time. I was a 31-year-old A-4 pilot, and like most pilots, I was a little superstitious. I had flown 5 bombing runs over North Vietnam without incident, and I preferred that all pre-flight tasks be performed in the same order as for my previous missions, believing an unvarying routine portended a safe flight. Wiping off my visor was one of the last tasks executed in that routine. Shortly before 11 on the morning of July 29, 1967, on Yankee Station in the Tonkin Gulf, I was third in line on the port side of the ship. I took my helmet from Tom, nodded at him as he flashed me a thumbs up, and shut the plane's canopy. In the next instant, a Zuni missile struck the belly fuel tank of my plane, tearing it open, igniting 200 gallons of fuel that spilled onto the deck, and knocking 2 of my bombs to the deck. I never saw Tom Ott again. Stray voltage from an electrical charge used to start the engine of a nearby F-4 Phantom, also waiting to take off, had somehow fired the 6-foot Zuni from beneath the plane's wing. At impact, my plane felt like it had exploded. I looked out at a rolling fireball as the burning fuel spread across the deck. I opened my canopy, raced onto the nose, crawled out onto the refueling probe, and jumped 10 feet into the fire. I rolled through a wall of flames as my flight suit caught fire. I put the flames out and ran as fast as I could to the starboard side of the deck. Shocked and shaking from adrenaline, I saw the pilot in the A-4 next to mine jump from his plane into the fire. His flight suit burst into flames. As I went to help him, a few crewmen dragged a fire hose toward the conflagration. Chief Petty Officer Gerald Ferrier ran ahead of me with a portable fire extinguisher. He stood in front of the fire and aimed the extinguisher at one of the 1,000-pound bombs that had been knocked loose from my plane and were now sitting in the flames on the burning deck. His heroism cost him his life. A few seconds later, the bomb exploded, blowing me back at least 10 feet and killing a great many men, including the burning pilot, the men with the hose, and Chief Ferrier. Small pieces of hot shrapnel from the exploded bomb tore into my legs and chest. All around me was mayhem. Planes were burning. More bombs cooked off. Body parts, pieces of the ship, and scraps of planes were dropping onto the deck. Pilots strapped in their seats, ejected into the firestorm. Men trapped by flames jumped overboard. More Zuni missiles streaked across the deck. Explosions tore craters in the flight deck, and burning fuel fell through the openings into the hangar bay, spreading the fire below. The fires were consuming the Forrestal. I thought she might sink. But the crew's heroics kept her afloat. Men sacrificed their lives for one another and for their ship. Many of them were only 18 and 19 years old. They fought the inferno all day and well into the next, and they saved the Forrestal. By the time the last blaze was brought under control, 134 men were dead or dying. Dozens more were wounded. More than 20 planes were destroyed. But the Forrestal managed to make its way slowly to Subic Naval Base in the Philippines. It would take 2 more years of repairs before the Forrestal would be seaworthy enough to return to duty. It appeared that my time at war was to be a very brief experience, and this distressed me considerably. I was a professional naval officer, and the purpose of my years of training had been to prepare me for this moment. As the crippled Forrestal limped toward port, my moment was disappearing when it had barely begun, and I feared my ambitions were among the casualties in the calamity that had claimed the Forrestal. Shortly after, an officer from the carrier USS Oriskany addressed my squadron to ask if any of us would consider volunteering for combat duty aboard his ship. The Oriskany had lately lost a number of pilots, and the squadron was considerably undermanned. A few others and I signed up. The year before the Forrestal fire, the Oriskany had also suffered a terrible disaster at sea when a magnesium flare had ignited a blaze that nearly destroyed the ship. 44 men had been killed. In addition, the carrier was suffering high casualties in 1967. The Oriskany was regarded as a dangerous place to live. I was relieved at this unexpected change in my fortunes. I met Carol and the kids in Europe and spent a pleasant family holiday, visiting my parents in London and relaxing on the French Riviera. I was still waiting for my final orders when we returned to Orange Park, Florida, which was near my last squadron's home base in Jacksonville, and where my family would await my return from combat duty. In September, my orders came through. On September 30th, 1967, I reported for duty to the Oriskany and joined VA-163, an A-4 attack squadron nicknamed the Saints. During the 3 years of Operation Rolling Thunder, the bombing campaign of North Vietnam begun in 1965, no carrier's pilots saw more action or suffered more losses than those on the Oriskany. When the Johnson administration halted Rolling Thunder in 1968, 38 pilots on the Oriskany had been either killed or captured. We had a reputation for aggressiveness and for success. In the months before I joined the squadron, the Saints had destroyed all the bridges to the port city of Haiphong. Like all combat pilots, we had a studied, almost macabre indifference to death that masked a great sadness in the squadron, a sadness that grew more pervasive as our casualty list lengthened. But we kept our game faces on, and our bravado became all the more exaggerated when the squadron returned to ship after a mission with one or more missing pilots. We flew the next raid with greater determination to do as much damage as we could, repeating to ourselves before the launch, if we destroy the target, we won't have to go back. We had one of the bravest, most resourceful squadron commanders, who was also one of the best A-4 pilots in the war, Commander Brian Compton. In August, 6 weeks before I reported for duty, Brian had led a daring raid on a thermal power plant in Hanoi. Brian Compton successfully petitioned for his squadron to receive smart bombs. Once the Saints were equipped with the new ordnance, he sought and received permission to bomb the power plant. He took just 5 other pilots from the squadron with him on the mission. Diving in from different points on the compass, through a terrible barrage of anti-aircraft fire and surface-to-air missiles, 5 of the 6 A-4s hit their target. The mission was a huge success, but rather than leaving off the attack as soon as the bombs had struck their target, Brian flew 2 more passes over the power plant, taking pictures of the bomb damage. For his courage and leadership of the raid, Brian received the Navy Cross. I was third pilot on another raid Brian led, this time over Haiphong. During the raid, the plane of the number 2 pilot was shot down. None of us saw him eject. Brian wanted to determine whether or not the missing pilot had managed to escape his destroyed aircraft and parachute safely to ground. He kept circling Haiphong at an extremely low altitude, about 2,000 feet, searching in vain for some sign that the pilot had survived. We were taking a tremendous pounding from flak and SAMs. I was scared to death, waiting for Brian to call off the search and lead us back to the Oriskany and out of harm's way. To this day, I will swear that Brian made at least 8 passes before he reluctantly gave up the search. Brian has since dismissed my account of his heroism as an exaggeration, claiming, "You can't trust a politician, they'll lie every time." But I remember what I saw that day. I saw a courageous squadron commander put his life in grave peril so that a friend's family might know if their loved one was alive or dead. For his heroics and his ability to survive them, the rest of the squadron regarded Brian as indestructible. We were proud to serve under his command. In the early morning of October 26, 1967, I prepared for my 23rd bombing run over North Vietnam. President Johnson had decided to escalate the war. The Saints were now dropping on Vietnam 150 tons of ordnance a day. Until this moment, we had found Johnson's prosecution of the war, with its frustratingly limited bombing targets, to be maddeningly illogical. When I was on the Forrestal, every man in my squadron had thought Washington's air war plans were senseless. The night before my first mission, I had gone up to the squadron's intelligence center to punch out information on my target. Out came a picture of a military barracks with some details about the target's recent history. It had already been bombed 27 times. Half a mile away, there was a bridge with truck tracks, but the bridge wasn't on the target list. The target list was so restricted that we had to go back and hit the same targets over and over again. Flying missions off the Oriskany, I often observed Soviet ships come into Haiphong Harbor and offload surface-to-air missiles. We could see the SAMs being transported to firing sites and put into place, but we couldn't do anything about them because we were forbidden to bomb SAM sites unless they were firing on us. Even then, it was often an open question whether we could retaliate or not. Most of the pilots flying the missions believed that our targets were virtually worthless. We had long believed that our attacks, more often than not limited to trucks, trains, and barges, were not just failing to break the enemy's resolve, but actually having the opposite effect by boosting Vietnam's confidence that it could withstand the full measure of American air power. In all candor, we thought our civilian commanders were complete idiots who didn't have the least notion of what it took to win the war. When the orders came down to escalate the bombing campaign, the pilots on the Oriskany were ecstatic. Today's attack on Hanoi was to be an alpha strike, a large raid on a militarily significant target, involving A-4s from my squadron and our sister squadron on the Oriskany, the Ghost Riders, as well as fighter escorts from the carrier's 2 F-8 squadrons. It would be my first attack on the enemy capital. The commander of the Oriskany's air wing, Commander Bert Shepard, the brother of astronaut Alan Shepard, would lead the strike. Our target was a thermal power plant, located near a small lake almost in the center of the city that the Saints had destroyed 2 months earlier. It had since been repaired. The day before, I had pleaded with Jim Busey, the Saints operations officer who was responsible for putting the flight schedule together, to let me fly the mission. The day before, we had bombed an airfield outside Hanoi, and I had destroyed 2 enemy MiGs parked on the runway. I was still charged up from the previous day's good fortune and was anticipating more success. The Oriskany Strike Operations Officer, Lou Chatham, told me he expected to lose some pilots. "Be careful," he said. I told him not to worry about me, that I was sure I would not be killed. I didn't know at the time that downed pilots imprisoned in the north referred to their shootdowns as the day they were killed. Hanoi, with its extensive network of Russian-manufactured SAM sites, had the distinction of possessing the most formidable air defenses in the history of modern warfare. I was about to discover just how formidable they were. We flew out to the west of Hanoi, turned, and headed in to make our run. We came in from the west so that once we had rolled in on the target, released our bombs, and pulled out, we would be flying directly toward the Tonkin Gulf. We had electronic countermeasure devices in our planes. In 1966, A-4s had been equipped with radar detection. A flashing light and different tone signals would warn us of imminent danger from enemy SAMs. One tone sounded when a missile's radar was tracking you, another when it had locked onto you. A third tone signaled a real emergency, that a launched SAM was headed your way. As soon as we hit land and approached the 3 concentric rings of SAMs that surrounded Hanoi, the tone indicating that missile radar was tracking sounded. It tracked us for miles. At about 9,000 feet, as we turned inbound on the target, our warning lights flashed, and the tone for enemy radar started sounding so loudly, I had to turn down the volume. I could see huge clouds of smoke and dust erupt on the ground as SAMs were fired at us. The closer we came to the target, the fiercer were the defenses. For the first time in combat, I saw thick black clouds of anti-aircraft flak everywhere, images familiar to me only from World War II movies. A SAM appears as a flying telephone pole, moving at great speed. We were now maneuvering through a nearly impassable obstacle course of anti-aircraft fire and flying telephone poles. They scared the hell out of me. 22 missiles were fired at us that day. One of the F-8s on the strike was hit. The pilot, Charlie Rice, managed to eject safely. I recognized the target sitting next to the small lake from the intelligence photos I had studied. I dove in on it just as the tone went off, signaling that a SAM was flying toward me. I knew I should roll out and fly evasive maneuvers, jinking in flyer's parlance, when I heard the tone. An A-4 can outmaneuver a tracking SAM, but I was just about to release my bombs when the tone sounded, and had I started jinking, I would never have had the time nor probably the nerve to go back in once I had lost the SAM. So at about 3,500 feet, I released my bombs, then pulled back the stick to begin a steep climb to a safer altitude. In the instant before my plane reacted, a SAM blew my right wing off. I was killed. I knew I was hit. My A-4, traveling at about 550 miles an hour, was violently spiraling to Earth. In this predicament, a pilot's training takes over. I didn't feel fear or any other excitement than I had already experienced during the run, my adrenaline surging as I dodged SAMs and flak to reach the target. I didn't think, gee, I'm hit, what now? I reacted automatically the moment I took the hit and saw that my wing was gone. I radioed, "I'm hit," reached up, and pulled the ejection seat handle. I struck part of the plane, breaking my left arm, my right arm in 3 places, and my right knee, and I was briefly knocked unconscious by the force of the ejection. Witnesses said my chute had barely opened before I plunged into the shallow water of Trukbak Lake. I landed in the middle of the lake, in the middle of the city, in the middle of the day. An escape attempt would have been challenging. I came to when I hit the water. Wearing about 50 pounds of gear, I touched the bottom of the shallow lake and kicked off with my good leg. I did not feel any pain as I broke the surface, and I didn't understand why I couldn't move my arms to pull the toggle on my life vest. I sank to the bottom again. When I broke the surface the second time, I managed to inflate my life vest by pulling the toggle with my teeth. Then I blacked out again. When I came to the second time, I was being hauled ashore on two bamboo poles by a group of about 20 angry Vietnamese. A crowd of several hundred Vietnamese gathered around me as I lay dazed before them, shouting wildly at me, stripping my clothes off, spitting on me, kicking and striking me repeatedly. When they had finished removing my gear and clothes, I felt a sharp pain in my right knee. I looked down and saw that my right foot was resting next to my left knee at a 90-degree angle. I cried out, "My God, my leg." Someone smashed a rifle butt onto my shoulder, breaking it. Someone else stuck a bayonet in my ankle and groin. A woman, who may have been a nurse, began yelling at the crowd and managed to dissuade them from further harming me. She then applied bamboo splints to my leg and right arm. It was with some relief that I noticed an army truck arrive on the scene to take me away from this group of aggrieved citizens. The soldiers then placed me on a stretcher, loaded me into the truck, and drove me a few blocks to an ochre-colored, trapezoid-shaped stone structure that occupied two city blocks in the center of downtown Hanoi. I was brought in through enormous steel gates, above which was painted the legend, Maison Centrale. I had been shot down a short walk's distance from the French-built prison, Wallo, which the POWs had named the Hanoi Hilton. As the massive steel doors loudly clanked shut behind me, I felt a deeper dread than I have ever felt again. They took me into an empty cell in a part of the prison we called the Desert Inn, set me down on the floor still in the stretcher, stripped to my underwear, and placed a blanket over me. For the next few days, I drifted in and out of consciousness. When awake, I was periodically taken to another room for interrogation. My interrogators accused me of being a war criminal and demanded military information, what kind of aircraft I had flown, future targets, and other particulars of that sort. In exchange, I would receive medical treatment. I thought they were bluffing and refused to provide any information beyond my name, rank, serial number, and date of birth. They knocked me around a little to force my cooperation, and I began to feel sharp pains in my fractured limbs. I blacked out after the first few blows. I thought if I could hold out like this for a few days, they would relent and take me to a hospital. For 4 days, I was taken back and forth to different rooms. Unable to use my arms, I was fed twice a day by a guard. I vomited after the meals, unable to hold down anything but a little tea. I remember being desperately thirsty all the time, but I could drink only when the guard was present for my twice-daily feedings. On about the fourth day, I realized my condition had become more serious. I was feverish and was losing consciousness more often and for longer periods. I was lying in my own vomit as well as my other bodily wastes. Two guards entered my cell and pulled the blanket down to examine my leg. I saw that my knee had become grossly swollen and discolored. I remembered a fellow pilot at Meridian who had broken his femur, ejecting from his plane. His blood had pooled in his leg and he had gone into shock and died. I realized the same thing was happening to me, and I pleaded for a doctor. The two guards left to find the camp officer, who spoke some English. He was short and fat, with a strangely wandering right eye that was clouded white by a cataract. The POWs called him Bug. He was a mean son of a bitch. Desperate, I tried to bargain with him. "Take me to the hospital and I'll give you the information you want." I didn't intend to keep my word, reasoning that after my injuries had been treated, I would be strong enough to deal with the consequences of not holding up my end of the bargain. Bug left without replying, but returned a short while later with a medic, a man the POWs called Zorba. Zorba squatted down and took my pulse. He turned to Bug, shook his head, and uttered a few words. Are you going to take me to the hospital? I asked. No, he replied. It's too late. I appealed. Take me to the hospital and I'll get well. It's too late, he repeated. He and the doctor left my cell, and panic that my death was approaching briefly overtook me. There were few amputees among the POWs who survived their imprisonment. The Vietnamese usually refused treatment to the seriously injured. I don't know whether they were negligent for purposes of cost efficiency, reasoning that Americans, unused to unsanitary conditions, were likely to develop fatal infections following an amputation, or if they refused us treatment simply because they hated us. Whatever the reason, a lot of men died who shouldn't have, the victims of genuine war crimes. I lapsed into unconsciousness a few minutes after Bug and Zorba left me to my fate, a condition that blessedly relieved me of the terrible dread I was feeling. I was awakened a short while later when an excited Bug rushed into my cell and shouted, "Your father is a big admiral. Now we take you to the hospital." God bless my father. My parents were in London when I was shot down. They were dressing for a dinner party when my father received a phone call saying that my plane had been shot down over Hanoi. My father informed my mother what had happened. They kept their dinner engagement, never mentioning to any of the other guests the distressing news they had just learned. When they returned home, my father got a call from his boss, Admiral Tom Moorer, Chief of Naval Operations. Admiral Moorer was a friend and had decided to break the sad news to my father himself. "Jack, we don't think he survived." My parents then called Carol, who had already been notified of my shootdown by the Navy. My mother told her to prepare for the worst, that I was dead, and they would have to find a way to accept that. My father, very matter-of-factly, said, "I don't think we have to." After speaking with Carol, my parents placed calls to my sister and brother to break the bad news to them. Joe was working as a reporter for the San Diego Tribune at the time. He knew something was wrong when he answered the phone and both our parents were on the line. Without any preliminaries, my mother said, "Honey, Johnny's been shot down." My father explained, "His wingman saw his plane explode. They don't think he got out." Joe began to cry. "What do we do now?" He recalled my father answering in a soft, sad voice, "Pray for him, my boy." The next day, October 28th, Johnny Apple wrote a story that appeared on the front page of the New York Times. Admiral McCain's son, Forrestal survivor, is missing in raid. I was moved by stretcher to a hospital in central Hanoi. As I was being moved, I again lapsed into unconsciousness. I came to a couple of days later and found myself lying in a filthy room, about 20 by 20 feet, lousy with mosquitoes and rats. Every time it rained, an inch of mud and water would pool on the floor. I was given blood and glucose and several shots. After several more days passed, during which I was frequently unconscious, I began to recover my wits. Other than the transfusion and shots, I received no treatment for my injuries. No one had even bothered to wash the grime off me. Once my condition had stabilized, my interrogators resumed their work. Demands for military information were accompanied by threats to terminate my medical treatment if I did not cooperate. Eventually, I gave them my ship's name and squadron number and confirmed that my target had been the power plant. Pressed for more useful information, I gave the names of the Green Bay Packers' offensive line and said they were members of my squadron. When asked to identify future targets, I simply recited the names of a number of North Vietnamese cities that had already been bombed. I was occasionally beaten when I declined to give any more information. The beatings were of short duration because I let out a hair-raising scream whenever they occurred. My interrogators appeared concerned that hospital personnel might object. I also suspected that my treatment was less harsh than might be accorded other prisoners. This I attributed to my father's position and the propaganda value the Vietnamese placed on possessing me, injured but alive. Later, my suspicion was confirmed when I heard accounts of other POWs' experiences during their first interrogations. They had endured far worse than I had and had withstood the cruelest torture imaginable. Although I rarely saw a doctor or nurse, I did have a constant companion, a teenage boy who was assigned to guard me. I still could not feed myself, so the boy would spoon-feed me a bowl of noodles with some gristle in it. The gristle was hard to chew. He would jam 3 or 4 spoonfuls in my mouth before I could chew and swallow any of it. Unable to force any more in my mouth, he would finish the bowl himself. I got 3 or 4 spoonfuls of food twice a day. After a while, I really didn't give a damn, although I tried to eat as much as I could before the boy took his share. After about a week in the hospital, a Vietnamese officer we called Chihuahua informed me that a visiting Frenchman had asked to look in on me and had volunteered to carry a message back to my family. I was willing to see him, assuming at the time that my family probably believed I was dead. As I later learned, the Vietnamese, always delighted when a propaganda opportunity presented itself, had already announced my capture and helpfully supplied quotes from the repentant war criminal commending the Vietnamese people's strong morale and observing that the war was turning against the United States. Prior to the Frenchman's arrival, I was rolled into a treatment room where a doctor tried to set my broken right arm. For what seemed like an eternity, he manipulated my arm without benefit of anesthesia, trying to set the 3 fractures. Blessedly, the pain at its most acute rendered me unconscious. Finally abandoning the effort, he slapped a large and heavy chest cast on me. The cast did not have a cotton lining, and the rough plaster painfully rubbed against my skin. Over time, it wore 2 holes in the back of my arm down to the bone. My other arm was left untreated. Exhausted and encased from my waist to my neck in a wet plaster cast, I was rolled into a large clean room and placed in a nice white bed. The room contained 6 beds, each protected by a mosquito net. A few minutes later, a Vietnamese officer, a Major Nguyen Bai, paid me a visit, accompanied by Chihuahua. He was the commandant of the entire prison system, a dapper, educated man whom the POWs had nicknamed the Cat. The Cat informed me that the Frenchman who would arrive shortly was a television journalist and that I should tell him everything I had told my interrogators. Surprised, I told the Cat I didn't want to be filmed. You need 2 operations on your leg, and if you don't talk to him, then we will take your cast off and you won't get any operations, he threatened. You will say you are grateful to the Vietnamese people and that you are sorry for your crimes, or we will send you back to the camp. I assured him that I would say nothing of the kind, but believing that the Cat would send me back to Hoa Lo, and worrying that I could not endure the truck ride back, I agreed to see the Frenchman. A few minutes later, Francois Chalet entered the room with 2 cameramen. He questioned me for several minutes, asking about my shoot-down, my squadron, the nature of my injuries, and my father. I repeated the same information about my ship and squadron and told him I was being treated well by the doctors who had promised to operate on my leg. Off camera, the Cat and Chihuahua were visibly displeased with my answers. Chihuahua demanded that I say more. I have no more to say about it, I replied. Both Vietnamese insisted that I express gratitude for the lenient and humane treatment I had received. I refused, and when they pressed me, Chalet said, I think what he told me is sufficient. Finally, Chalet asked if I had a message for my family. I would just like to tell my wife that I'm going to get well. I love her and hope to see her soon. I appreciate it if you'd tell her that. That's all I have to say. Chihuahua told me to say that I could receive letters and pictures from home. No, I replied. A visibly agitated Cat demanded that I say on camera how much I wanted the war to end so I could go home. Again, Chalet stepped in to help me, saying very firmly that he was satisfied with my answer and that the interview was over. I appreciated his help. Although I had resisted giving my interrogators any useful information and had greatly irritated the Cat by refusing his demands during the interview, I should not have given out information about my ship and squadron, and I regret very much having done so. The information was of no real use to the Vietnamese, but the Code of Conduct for American Prisoners of War orders us to refrain from providing any information beyond our name, rank, and serial number. When Chalet had left, the Cat admonished me for my bad attitude and told me I wouldn't receive any more operations. I was taken back to my old room. It was hard not to see how pleased the Vietnamese were to have captured an admiral's son, and I knew that my father's identity was directly related to my survival. Often during my hospital stay, I received visits from high-ranking officials. Bug arrived one day and had me listen to a tape of a POW denouncing America's involvement in the war. Bug told me he wanted me to make a similar statement. "I don't feel that way about the war," I replied, and was threatened for what seemed like the 100th time with a warning that I would be denied an operation because of my bad attitude. In early December, they operated on my leg. The Vietnamese filmed the operation. I haven't a clue why. Regrettably, it wasn't much of a success. The doctor severed all the ligaments on one side of my knee, which has never fully recovered. After the war, thanks to the work of a kind and talented physical therapist, my knee regained much of its mobility, enough anyway, for me to return to flight status for a time. But today, when I am tired or when the weather is inclement, my knee stiffens in pain and I pick up a trace of my old limp. They decided to discharge me later that December. I'd been in the hospital about 6 weeks. I was in bad shape. I had a high fever and suffered from dysentery. I'd lost about 50 pounds and weighed barely 100. I was still in my chest cast and my leg hurt like hell. On the brighter side, at my request, the Vietnamese were taking me to another prison camp. Bug had entered my room one day and abruptly announced, "The doctors say you are not getting better." The accusatory tone he used to relay this all too obvious diagnosis implied that I was somehow responsible for my condition and had deliberately tried to embarrass the Vietnamese medical establishment by refusing to recover. "Put me with other Americans," I responded, "and I'll get better." Bug said nothing in reply. That evening, I was blindfolded, placed in the back of a truck, and driven to a truck repair facility that had been converted into a prison a few years earlier. It was situated in what had once been the gardens of the mayor of Hanoi's official residence. The Americans held there called it the plantation. To my great relief, I was placed in a cell in a building we called the gun shed with two other prisoners, both Air Force majors, George Bud Day and Norris Overly. I could have asked for no better companions. There was never a doubt in my mind that Bud Day and Norris Overly saved my life. Bud and Norris later told me that their first impression of me was of a man at the threshold of death. Despite my poor condition, I was overjoyed to be in the company of Americans. I had by this time been a prisoner of war for 2 months, and I hadn't even caught a glimpse of another American. I was frail, but voluble. I wouldn't stop talking all through that first day with Bud and Norris, explaining my shoot-down, describing my treatment since capture, inquiring about their experiences, and asking for all the details of the prison system and for information about other prisoners. Bud and Norris were the soul of kindness as they eased my way to what they believed was my imminent death. Bud had been seriously injured when he ejected. Like me, he had broken his right arm in 3 places and had torn the ligaments in his knee, the left knee in his case. After his capture near the DMZ, he had attempted an escape and had nearly reached an American airfield when he was recaptured. He was brutally tortured for his efforts and for subsequently resisting his captors' every entreaty for information. First held in a prison in Vinh before making the 150-mile trip north to Hanoi, Bud had experienced early the full measure of the mistreatment that would be his fate for nearly 6 years. His captors had looped rope around his shoulders, tightened it until his shoulders were nearly touching, and then hung him by the arms from the rafter of the torture room, tearing his shoulders apart. Left in this condition for hours, Bud never acceded to the Vietnamese demands for military information. They had to refracture his broken right arm and threaten to break the other before Bud gave them anything at all. He was a tough man, a fierce resister, whose example was an inspiration to every man who served with him. For his heroic escape attempt, he received the Medal of Honor, one of only 3 POWs in Vietnam to receive the nation's highest award. Because of his injuries, Bud was unable to help with my physical care. Norris shouldered most of the responsibility. A gentle, uncomplaining guy, he cleaned me up, fed me, helped me onto the bucket that served as our toilet, and massaged my leg. Thanks to his tireless ministration and to the restorative effect Bud and Norris's company had on my morale, I began to recover. I slept a lot those first weeks, 18 to 20 hours a day. Little by little, I grew stronger. In early January, we were relocated to another end of the camp, a place we called the Corn Crib. We had neighbors in the cells on either side of ours, and for the first time, we managed to establish communications with fellow POWs. Our methods were crude, yelling to each other whenever the turnkeys were absent, and leaving notes written in cigarette ash in a washroom drain. It would be some time before we devised more sophisticated and secure communication methods. One day, a young English-speaking officer escorted a group of older, obviously senior party members, into our cell. For a few moments after entering, the entire group just stared at me. Finally, the young officer began asking me questions in English, translating my answers for the assembled dignitaries. "How many corporations does your family own?" Puzzled by the question, I looked at him for a moment before asking, "What do you mean?" "How many corporations does your family own? Your father is a big admiral. He must have many companies that work with your government." Laughing at the absurd premise of the question, I replied, "You've got to be putting me on. My father is a military officer whose income is confined to his military salary." When my answer had been translated, the crowd of high-ranking officials, all of whom had thrived in a system of government infamously riddled with corruption, smiled and nodded at each other, dismissing my protest as unimaginative propaganda. Around that time, we began to notice that the Vietnamese were showing us unusual leniency. Our diet improved a little. The cat would often visit us and inquire about our health and how we were getting along. No one invested much effort in interrogating us. We were suspicious of the Vietnamese's motives, but initially we were at a loss to figure out their purpose. We weren't in the dark for long. One evening in early February, Norris told us that the Vietnamese were considering releasing him along with two other prisoners. For a couple of weeks, the Vietnamese had regularly interrogated Norris. Unbeknownst to us, they'd been quizzing Norris to determine whether he was willing and suitable to be included in their first grant of amnesty. Bud advised him to reject the offer. The code of conduct obliged us to refuse release before those who had been captured earlier had been released. The next day, Norris was removed from our cell. The day of his release, February 16th, I was carried on a stretcher with Bud walking beside me to a room where we were to bid Norris goodbye. A crew was filming the departure ceremony. Bud asked if he had been required to make any propaganda statement or do anything else he might later on regret. Norris said that he had not, and we let the matter drop. Some of the prisoners were pretty hard on Norris and the other two prisoners for taking early release. Norris had taken very good care of me.